10,000 miles from Spain, in a remote corner of the Philippine archipelago, a ship was burning. The blaze turned night into day, and its reflection formed hypnotic patterns on the inky, swelling sea. As it hissed and sent a pungent vapor skyward, the blaze consumed the ship's timbers down to the water's edge. The dull red glow from the waterborne bonfire was visible for miles around. The next morning, thick smoke from the dying embers of the charred hull turned day into night. The ship was Concepcion, one of the three vessels that had escaped the massacre at Cebu the previous day. Since then, the survivors had tried to navigate the three large vessels around the uncharted shoals and islands of the Philippines, but they soon discovered that they were hopelessly shorthanded. To add to their problems, Concepcion's master, Juan Sebastian Elcano, complained that shipworms infested the hull. Magellan, had he been alive, would have ordered the men to undertake arduous repairs, but the survivors adopted a more pragmatic approach and decided to burn the ship to prevent it from falling into the hands of an enemy who might use it against them. The crew transferred the contents of Concepcion to the two other ships, Trinidad, still the flagship of the fleet, and Victoria. And then, on the night of May 2, 1521, the empty ship was set ablaze. A hasty vote among the sailors placed Espinosa in command of Victoria, while João López Carvalho, the Portuguese pilot, won election as the new captain general. Elcano, the master of Victoria, silently cursed the new captain general, who might be a talented pilot but was incapable of imposing discipline on the unruly fleet. The new command placed Pigafetta in a vulnerable position. He had always identified himself as a Magellan loyalist, but the captain general's inner circle had all perished or disappeared. Only Pigafetta survived. He believed he would continue to serve as the expedition's chief chronicler, as well as its chief interpreter, because he alone had trouble to make a methodical study of the Malay tongue. He lacked Enrique's facility with it, but he knew how to make himself understood and to obtain information. Equally important, he was familiar with Filipino customs. Carvalho and the newly elected leaders of the expedition agreed, and Pigafetta's role in the post-Magellan era was, if anything, enhanced. After the multiple tragedies the Armada had suffered in the Philippines, commercial considerations ruled their actions. Never again would they erect crosses or insist on mass conversions. Knowing they were lucky to be alive, the men turned their attention to reaching the Spice Islands, where they hoped to find safety, supplies, and the precious commodity for which they had sailed halfway around the world. Carvalho faced the task of leading the fleet's two remaining ships southward through the archipelago to the Moluccas, but the arrival of the rainy season in the Philippines and its storms often made navigation next to impossible. They had adapted to sailing over vast stretches of open water, but now they had to thread their way through a labyrinth of islands. For the short distances and intricate maneuvering involved, they needed a reliable map or, failing that, a guide familiar with these waters. But after their horrific experiences on Cebu and Mactan, the sailors were reluctant to call at strange islands and ask for help. Occasionally, the fleet was approached by balangay, powered by rowers chanting in unison. Whenever possible, Pigafetta asked the rowers for directions to the Moluccas, but the others kept their relations with the islanders to a bare minimum. Carvalho, aided by Albo, the pilot, veered from one island to another, following a meandering but generally southerly course through the labyrinth of the Philippine archipelago to the Moluccas. Albo's methodical record, barely mentioning the ambush at Cebu, tracked the fleet's wanderings, as if the ships were wounded beasts in search of a healing sanctuary. Still unable to pinpoint the Spice Islands, the fleet was veering seriously off course, heading west into the Sulu Sea toward China rather than south to the Spice Islands. In its wanderings, the fleet called on the island of Cagayan, as Pigafetta designated it, He went ashore to establish relations with the islanders. Other crew members accompanied him. Their mission? To find enough food to restock their rapidly dwindling stores before they starved. Their fleet encountered a predatory culture. Pigafetta said, "The people of that island are Moros, Moors, and were banished from an island called Burn, Borneo. They go naked, as do the others. They have blowpipes and small quivers at their side, full of arrows and a poisonous herb. They have gold daggers, whose hafts are adorned with gold and precious gems, spears, bucklers, and small cuirasses of buffalo horn." Fortunately, these menacing-looking warriors believed that the European intruders were holy beings and spared them from harm. But the ravenous sailors found no food to speak of, and, growing desperate, the armada embarked on a 25-league detour to the northwest, almost directly away from the Spice Islands. Their search for food grew more frantic. Pigafetta wrote, "We were often on the point of abandoning the ships in order that we might not die of hunger." "At last," he wrote, "they arrived at the land of promise, because we suffered great hunger before we found it." The island was called Palawan, and it divides the Sulu Sea from the South China Sea. Although the fleet was getting even farther from its goal, Palawan offered a tropical paradise to men who had endured so much for so long. When the crew had rested and loaded provisions onto the ships, they weighed anchor, and on June 21, 1521, prepared to leave Palawan. This time, they had on board a local pilot, a Negrito, who gave his name as Bastia, and said that he was a Christian, but he vanished just before the fleet left the harbor. In search of a replacement, Carvalho ordered the fleet to encircle a large barangay. Feigning peaceful intentions, the armada captured all three of the barangay's pilots, believing that they would lead the way to the Spice Islands at last. But these pilots, all of them Arabs, complicated matters by directing the armada southwest toward Brunei, an Arab stronghold, rather than southeast toward the Moluccas. This was a hazardous crossing, replete with shoals and sandbanks, and the fleet needed the pilots' assistance to reach Brunei. Reaching the mouth of the harbor, the fleet followed junks whose pilots were familiar with the route to safety. At last they dropped anchor in the harbor of Brunei, in the midst of a realm of enchantment and luxury that would surpass anything they had previously experienced on the voyage. The fleet remained anchored off Brunei for 6 peaceful days, allowing the men to recover, at least partly, from the violence that had marked the last few weeks. From the decks of their ships, the men could see an assortment of elevated houses constructed over a complicated series of waterways, piers, and boardwalks. Behind the city, tall palms stood as sentries. At night, dim fires flickered in the distance and sent slender plumes skyward. If the sailors listened carefully, they could hear faint voices from the shore echoing across the surface of the water, and even a kind of primitive music consisting of gongs and bells and chanting. It was a scene of domestic tranquility transplanted to an exotic setting, but the men were afraid to leave their ships and explore the unknown. The fleet's isolation ended when the king of Brunei, Raja Sirapada, dispatched a convoy of proas to beguile and seduce them. Arriving with great pomp, so Pigafetta wrote, they encircled the ships with musical instruments playing and drums and brass gongs beating. They saluted us with their peculiar cloth caps, which cover only the tops of their heads. We saluted them by firing our mortars without stones, that is, bullets. Then they gave us a present of various kinds of food made only of rice. Some were wrapped in leaves and were made in somewhat longish pieces. Some resembled sugar loaves, while others were made in the manner of tarts, with eggs and honey. They told us that their king was willing to let us get water and wood and to trade at our pleasure. The king's messenger promised to help them with all their needs. Genis de Mafra recalled, the messenger was an old man, handsome and well-dressed. He wore gold jewelry on his fingers, neck, and ears. He wanted to know where they were going, and when they spoke of the Moluccas, he scoffed. There was nothing there but clothes, he advised. But if they were determined to go, he would supply a pilot for each ship. Demophra said, "For this our men thanked him, and then asked whether there was in that land any pitch with which to caulk the ships." After months in tropical water, the hulls badly needed reconditioning. The messenger explained, said Demophra, they caulked their own boats with a pitch they made with coconut oil and wax, for which they could send out some people to town, where they could find many things to buy. And again he invited the men to stay a while and sample the pleasures of Brunei. The repeated entreaties from the mysterious island ruler eventually had their intended effect, and the crew members reciprocated by sending a delegation. The delegation transferred from Trinidad to the proa, bearing gifts salvaged from the wreckage of the fleet. After a short trip over water, the delegation reached an elaborate city, entirely built in salt water, said Pigafetta, except for the houses of the king and certain chiefs. It contains 25,000 fires, that is to say, hearths, indicating family units. Pigafetta continued, the houses are all constructed of wood and built up from ground on tall pillars. When the tide is high, the women go in boats through the settlement, selling the articles necessary to maintain life. There is a large brick wall in front of the king's house with towers like a fort, in which were mounted 56 bronze pieces and 6 of iron. The gunpowder for these weapons was likely imported from China, where it was invented. After months of drifting among more primitive tribes, the armada had finally reached a civilization at least as advanced as their own.